Okay, let's get started. Good morning, everyone. Happy Friday. I thought as an introduction, I'll just summarize what we discussed the last time, sort of the hallmarks. So we talked about some fundamental principles, how to think about metabolic reactions in cells by simply dividing them in terms of their biological function. So we have anabolic pathways that are involved in synthesis of cell mass, organic matter that assemble into new cells. And then we have in the red arrows a set of compounds that serve in the catabolism. And typically, all catabolism is redox chemistry, so we have an oxidative reaction, series of reactions that are in pathways, they're different pathways, glycolysis, citric acid cycle, they're all sort of categorized or can be lumped together in this pathway, and then have a series of reductive reactions. That's a universal principle that you can apply to aerobic, to anaerobic, and also to phototrophic organisms. The connection between catabolic and anabolic pathway is there is a flux of ATP from the catabolic part. There's typically a flux of reducing equivalents that are required for biosynthetic reactions, or actually in the reverse reaction. For example, if an organism uses as a carbon substrate a compound that is more reduced than the average carbon in the cell. So for example, if fatty acids would be the source, the only source of carbon, then there need to be a net flux of electrons from an anabolic pathway to a catabolic pathway in order to accommodate for the difference in oxidation state. And there are also some, especially for organic compounds, other intermediates that are transferred from the catabolic to the anabolic pathway. There are consequences, environmental consequences of this metabolism. There are consequences in the sense that not only one substrate, but two substrates are depleted from the environment, and the consequences that two products are formed and introduced into the environment. And that's universally true. In addition, we are transforming compounds from elements into cells. So there are environmental consequences of this metabolism. Now, we also saw that there are variations of this theme that have other implications for how the organism interacts with the environment in the sense of changing the environment. For example, phototrophic organisms, which do not have a net electron transport to synthesize ATP. It's a cyclic process, so there's actually no electron economy in their catabolic part. And this creates challenges for phototrophic organisms that have other environmental consequences, specifically because most phototrophs are autotrophs, they fix CO2. So as a source of electrons, other compounds from the environment has to be recruited and oxidized so that these electrons then can be used to reduce CO2 to the oxidation level of carbon in the cell. That leaves an environmental footprint. For example, if these organisms use water as electron source for CO2 fixation, this produces oxygen. If hydrogen sulfide is used, this produces elemental sulfur or sulfate in the environment, which then creates a new niche, because now all of a sudden, as a consequence of the anabolic reactions, a new compound, let's say like sulfate or oxygen, becomes available in the environment and opens up a new niche. And we also talked as a variation of that lithotrophic organisms, which in this case, in our example, we used hydrogen sulfide, but you can also use ammonia oxidizers, where you also have to manage an electron flow, a substantial electron flow, and energy flow towards CO2 fixation, simply based on the redox potentials that are involved. We put this together in the microbial mat, and we had a great discussion, I think it was Tuesday evening, with the students, to explain from a metabolic scenario in terms of causes and consequences of simple anabolism and catabolism, how a MET invariably, no matter where you go on Earth, under the same environmental conditions, I wouldn't say assemble, but simply ecologically selects for this type of metabolic interaction, where we had the connection between the end product of water oxidation generates oxygen, and oxygen is then the source for aerobic organisms or for colorless sulfur bacteria that use hydrogen sulfide, which is the end product of sulfate-reducing bacteria here in the deeper part. If you understand this connection, and you might, the best way I found to learn this is to explain it to your friend. Because that means you're taking these thoughts in and really explain it. Okay.
Could you explain this picture really quick?
No. I did this and I need to move on. But I'd be happy to talk about this later. So, what we haven't, so far we essentially more or less talked or put an emphasis on this anabolic part. And I said there is a certain paucity of diversity in anabolic reactions across different forms of life. The real diversity in the microbial world is essentially how organisms access environmental energy and how they use this energy. And I want to use today to talk more about this. And I want to introduce you to a profound experiment that was done by Julian Adams and co-workers at the end, I think it was 87 or 88. And he basically asked the question, what happens if I take E. coli and grow it under the most constant conditions in a chemostat? So a chemostat is a system that in equilibrium has a constant flow rate, inflow rate, where nutrients are introduced, the optical density of the cells does not change, and the organisms, in this case, E. coli, uses glucose, oxidizes glucose to CO2 with oxygen as electron acceptor, and that's bubbled in here, and then the unused resources, as well as the recently formed cells, are basically flowing out. And the nice thing of a chemostat is, based on the flow rate, you dial in the growth rate. So you can set the system at different growth rates. If you keep the flow rate constant, basically you're operating this at a constant growth rate, which has great advantages over studies in batch where you have selection for fast growth. Here you set the growth rate. All right. So inoculated this with a single E. coli and grew it for about 800 generations. The outcome was the following, and actually a surprise. If you plate then the content of the chemostat, simply morphologically, they observed different colony morphologies. There were smaller colony variants, small colony variants, and large colony variants. The other surprising thing was the ancestral strain was basically gone. If a student comes to the PI and says, look what I found, he said, oh, you got a contamination, go back and do it again. If you do it again, you get actually the same outcome. So obviously, just simply morphologically, different variants arose in this experiment and were present. The question is, are they stably coexisting, or is this a transition between different states? Because obviously, this chemostat deviated from being equilibrium because organisms changed. So the experiment to do was to inoculate a new chemostat with wild type, with a small colony variant and large colony variants. And I should say, when they analyzed the small colony variants in batch, not in a chemostat, they had a higher maximum growth rate than relative to the wild type, and also a lower KM for glucose, in other words, a higher affinity for glucose. So something was different in glucose metabolism of the small colony variants. Again, if you introduce these three organisms in a new chemostat and then grow it for another 800 generations, they found that wild type was gone, but the small colony variants and the large colony variants were stably maintained. And from an ecological point of view, that means these organisms obviously don't occupy the same niche, because otherwise, based on the niche exclusion principle, only one should be. So that's interesting. Obviously, evolution produced variants, and these organisms are derived from this ancestral strain, that are in this ecosystem more fit than the wild type. So, and they don't compete with each other. Right? They competed with the wild type and out-competed the wild type. And since the only resource in the system was glucose and oxygen, and since they are stably maintained, this resource glucose needs to be partitioned to both of them. That means while the wild-type strain completely could use glucose, these variants will use only a fraction of the available resources, but it makes them fitter than the wild-type. Yes?
So did they check that the after you seed them in the ground for a long time, that the large colonies are really descendant from the seeds of the large colony ones? So that, I mean, it could be that the small colony ones are constantly winning, but spawning variants that are large colony.
Yeah. So the point was of this experiment was actually to show that they are ecologically stable. It's not, the emphasis is not actually on the evolution, how you get there. I think that's interesting. And that's actually a different point. This point means they were stably coexisting. Does that make sense? Okay. So obviously the resource glucose is partitioned between these strains, because two organisms exist in different niches with only glucose as the single source. So to figure out what was going on, they did essentially a nice microbiological experiment. They grew each of these strains in a test tube on glucose, and then tested the supernatant of each culture, whether or not the supernatant contained nutrients where either of these strains could grow. The outcome was that, the small colony variant produced something that allowed the large colony variants to grow. So there was a cross-feeding and interaction. It turned out, on the metabolic basis, so years later, that it was an acetate cross-feeding. So here's our wild type, the ancestral strain, uses glucose, oxidizes glucose to pyruvate, then through citric acid cycle, and then respiration to CO2. The small colony variant, indicated here by a larger arrow, becomes better adapted to use glucose, because the strain had a higher rate of glucose utilization than the ancestral strain and a lower KM. But it was incomplete and excreted acetate. Acetate then provided a new niche to which the large colony variants then adapted. Large colony variants become maladapted to use glucose, but better adapted to use acetate, and then oxidized acetate to CO2. It's a great speciation. It's a great food chain that you find in many environmental systems. The question is, why is that? Obviously, an organism that uses this resource incompletely becomes more fit than an organism that uses has more resources available. Yes.
Do you know if the total biomass per gram of glucose was higher or lower in the new colonies?
Great question. Can you rephrase it again?
Yeah. Is the total amount of biomass larger or smaller with the two, the mutants versus the ancestral strain.
We'll get back to that, but you rose an important question. The total mass, relative biomass, relative produced per glucose consumed, or you can also measure per CO2 formed or acetate formed. And that gives you different numbers. So that's a great thought. And if you do that, you need to think about to what you actually normalize this. So I'll get back to this in a second. Okay, so if you put some number in there and enzymatic step, the ancestral strain produces about 24 ATPs, 23 steps, and the acetate cross-feeding basically cuts this in half. So, but obviously, with a less efficient utilization of resource, this strain became more fit in this ecosystem than the ancestral strain. So, just a summary, the small colony variance appeared to be a predictable feature of the outcome in this experiment, so that's the evolution part. It leads to speciation. So, with this experiment, we can ultimately understand how speciation actually occurs that we find in nature. We'll review that. The small colony variant had a superior glucose uptake, but it also used glucose inefficient. Some evolved organism became more successful because they used the substrate less well. That's a hard one to swallow, but it's true. And the less efficient types are maintained because they do not compete for glucose, but rather grow on the excreted metabolite. That's a general sort of principle that you can think of. So how do we understand this? There is a theory that was developed in Sebastian Bonhoeffer's lab around 2000 and in the following year, which started with the following. So we are looking at metabolism, catabolism, where substrate is converted into a product. And in these pathways, we have several sites where ATP is conserved. As I had introduced already in the first class, the overall free energy that is available in this reaction to convert substrate to product has two terms. One term is where the energy is used to synthesize ATP. So it's the delta G for ATP formation times the coupling sites. So here we have three, this NATP would be three, plus a term where the energy was not used for ATP conservation, simply because there was not enough, or there were mechanistically no way to conserve this energy. So therefore, this delta G net, the unused energy, is basically the difference between both. If the system is in equilibrium, that means all available energy is used to synthesize, so delta G net is zero, and then we have the maximum number of ATPs that are formed. Okay. If you're looking now at the flux of the substrate through this pathway, it's the S over dt, and now the flux of ATP is NATP times the flux of the substrate. So you get more ATP, depending on the stoichiometry. Now, if the system is in equilibrium, then in equilibrium, there is no net flux. And the system is in equilibrium if delta G net is zero. So in order to have some flux, the flux is proportional actually to the delta G net. And if you resolve this and substitute the delta G net with this part and the, so you resolve this for the delta G S to substrate, and then you have this term, you ultimately can show that the substrate, the flux of the substrate is some constant where another constant, which is specific to this substrate, N max minus N ATP. And NATP, that's the biology. That's basically what the pathway is in order to extract energy. But that means that the rate And it's also related to ATP just because of the stoichiometry of NATP. That means that the flux is actually inversely proportional to the efficiency NATP of the pathway. And you can, you know, roughly plot this as this anti-correlation, which basically means there is a rate yield trade-off. So just to finish this, if you have a high flux, basically means there is a low NATP, in other words, a low yield or efficiency in extracting the available energy.
So this assumes you're not eating the ATP, right? If you're sort of sucking the ATP out of the thing, then the flux of the whole thing might be dominated by that, not by this argument.
Right. So this is just a field theory just based on the catabolic pathway. I think that's, yes.
So why is the flux proportional to the change of free energy?
Because if it's in equilibrium, meaning
zero.
Yes. And therefore, in order to have a net flux, delta G net must be negative.
Right. And why is it proportional? Why is it linear?
That's an assumption. Simple as
that. Okay.
First order Taylor.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
This is assuming there's no energetic barrier to that's not setting the time scale.
This does, there's no specific pathway in mind at this point. But as a general way, you can from first principles you can say there is an inverse relationship between the rate of a pathway and the yield. So. What I'm going to argue and show you examples for is actually how nature more or less populated this inverse correlation. And obviously, nature does not fit perfectly on this slope, but there are essentially chemical and biochemical constraints. But the evolution of organisms and these mechanistic constraints moved basically the organisms in this direction. The Julian Adams experiment showed basically how, starting from an ancestral strain, you have an evolution to this phenotype and to this phenotype. Right. If you look at the extant organisms, especially in the anaerobic world, you find that examples, and I'll give you examples, how this is populated by organisms that you can think of speciated in this way. Okay. Why acetate? So I'm a microbial biochemist. Why is it that acetate? So we have to look at pathways in order to understand where does a pathway speciate? So what I did here, I plotted all the delta G's under standard state conditions of the entire pathway. So here we have glycolysis. Here we have the citric acid cycle. And here we have respiration. And these are the numbers these are the names of the enzymes. So glycolysis starts with the consumption of ATP, and then from phosphoenolpyruvate and glyceraldehyde 3 phosphate dehydrogenase, you get ATP. So you end up at in the end as pyruvate. The pyruvate then goes into via pyruvate dehydrogenase into the citric acid cycle, which is pretty much exergonic, in addition to providing an ATP via substrate level phosphorylation. And these ATPs are synthesized via respiration. You can actually see how efficient respiration really is, because in this electron flux, there's only a small this is delta G net, what we are looking at here, because ATP is formed. So the delta G net in respiration is fairly small. In the citric acid cycle, you have larger ones. And here also in glycolysis, sort of larger delta G nets. And that gives, again, sort of some directionality. Why acetate? Well, when glucose is consumed, there's ATP consumption. And in order to make a net balance, you have to be actually here, because otherwise there is a drain of resources. In the citric acid cycle, once you're there, you may break and excrete compounds here, But because you know the citric acid cycle is a cyclic process, which requires oxaloacetate at the end of the cycle to accept the next acetyl-CoA, if you break the cycle, it stops. For acetate oxidation, like some anaerobes have, you could imagine other intermediates, but not for the citric acid cycle. So, selection is not on producing into any intermediates of the citric acid cycle as a cross-feeding compound, and it has to be basically in this range. So it's either pyruvate or acetate.
In principle, you could imagine a case in the citric acid cycle, you could take something off. I mean, you just have to replenish them. I don't think, in principle, it makes a difference.
Yes, but there's a cost then involved with that. So if the cells then basically use sort of the equivalent of another acetate to replenish this, then they
but in terms of total carbon, let's say alpha-ketoglutarate comes out.
Right.
Okay. And then you just need to feed several acetate to get in terms of carbon still the same.
Right, but it's in that sense it's more efficient to use just acetate to recover energy rather than to build and adapt the molecule to oxidize one acetate. So the penalty of...
Well, what do you mean by efficiency?
Well, because then, you know, if you make an anastomer, you go from acetate to pyruvate, which is very expensive, and then from pyruvate to carboxylate this to oxaloacetate, which is really expensive. There are at least three or four ATPs involved just to convert an acetate into oxaloacetate, if you would exclude alpha-ketoglutarate.
I don't know. I mean, you keep on feeding TCA in the normal way. Right. You just drain some, say, alpha-ketoglutarate, right? And you need to supply oxaloacetate.
Right.
Fine, okay, but you pick up some free carbon too. Is
this interesting for you guys? Or no? All right. Okay. The point here was, based on the constraints of the biochemical pathway involved, there are the alternatives out, but that's what E. coli has, glycolysis, citric acid cycle, there's pretty much only this window, and that is basically chosen by evolution. Boris.
In this window, it's minus 2 plus 2 is 0.
The window, I meant, not thermodynamic, I mean, it's the window in terms of pyruvate or acetate. The chemical window.
But I'm just counting ATP in and out. We still need to make money on that.
Yeah, all right. If you take glucose, you produce 2-pyruvate. You get 4 reducing equivalents. And then pyruvate goes to acetate. Actually, it goes to acetyl-CoA. And then to acetate. And you make 2 ATPs here. And you get another 4 reducing equivalents here. If E. coli figured out a way to deal with these reducing equivalents, you're net positive by 2 ATPs. Keep this in mind, hold this thought here, where do these electrons go? Because we are saying here, actually, E. coli evolved to throw out these pathways. TCA functionally, TCA cycle and respiration. That's fine because it allows the organism to go faster, but it still generates reducing equivalents here. Not as much as if acetate would be oxidized, but still. So there needs to be a solution for that. Okay. Are we good with this? There's another way, also from a theory that they developed, which says for a given NATP, sort of for a given strategy of ATP consumption, there is an optimal pathway length, which assumes the following. So if you have a pathway, a long pathway, and with a number of pathway steps, if you make it longer and longer and longer, then you can actually collect more ATP. It makes sense. It's intuitive. On the other hand, when you collect more ATP from your resource, your flux will go down. That's the rate yield trade-off. And with the relationship that they established, they basically said for a given NATP, an intrinsic metabolic feature of a pathway, there's sort of an optimum pathway length. This assumption was based on that, well, more ATP is produced the longer the pathway is, and that the total concentration of catabolic enzyme is minimized because of the cost of synthesis for competing enzymes. Therefore, it was the idea that the space of a cell inside is essentially prime real estate. And Terry has done a few years ago some really beautiful work. And I think you're talking about this next week, and I just want to touch on that. How to think about and how do you measure this proteome space? Because the cell essentially has its proteome. And the question is, how does the cell allocate the proteome? You allocate the proteome with a lot of proteins or machinery for protein synthesis or for energy conservation. And in a simplification, so Terry showed in this and measured these actually experimentally, which is great. So that if E. coli grows slowly, you have a large fraction, actually the largest fraction of the protein content is anabolic. And then in this part, you have essentially catabolic functions. And they can be subdivided in fermentation, which is essentially glycolysis, and respiration. If the organism grows slow, the circle is finite, so is the space, the proteome of the cell. If the cells grow faster, we know that the biosynthetic capacity is linearly related to the growth rate. We know it from ribosomes. If the cells grow faster, if they grow twice as fast, there are twice as many ribosomes. And from the flux, you need to accommodate for that. So the difference here is that this part here, which was allocated to the proteome of catabolism, is now taken by the anabolism because the cells grow faster. So where's the trade-off? And Terry found that essentially when an E. coli grows faster, it actually switches towards a more fermentative metabolism at the expense of reducing the proteome for fermentation. And this leads to acetate production when E. coli grows fast. So not only in this evolution experiment, you essentially have this switch in this allocation, but also when the organisms grow normally. And that is related to the fact that you essentially have, for a given NATP, there's an optimum pathway length. And I think you're going to talk about it. So what I want to do now for the rest of the time, give you a few examples in the microbial world for this rate yield trade-off. I'm going to show you how a single cell, just like E. coli, regulates the rate yield trade-off and can use this as a physiological response to different environments and environmental conditions. I talk about how this actually then also drives speciation, and I'll also show how this brings metabolic features in ecosystems. So in other words, when you're doing metagenomics and reconstructing pathways from the metagenome and interpret this metagenome in order to predict what is the flux, what is the competition in your ecosystem, you can see patterns of that. Okay. First of all, differences between organisms. So this is the respiratory chain in Pseudomonas, mitochondria, and Paracoccus. Here we have Helicobacter, here's E. coli. The overall reaction, S goes to P, is exactly the same, because we are oxidizing NADH, which we get from some oxidative pathway, and reducing oxygen. That's what all this pathway does. So we have the classical steps, complex 1, NADH dehydrogenase, which pumps 4 protons out. Qualifier, there's already a variation there. There are different NADH dehydrogenases that pump different number of protons, anywhere from 4 to 1. In this case, they're all 4. Then we have electrons are transferred to prenone. Then complex 3 is ubiquinol dehydrogenase. And then in this case, we have a reduction of a cytochrome, and complex 4 is then a cytochrome C oxidase. Proton pumping is, so we have 4 here, we have 4 here, and we have 2, which gives us basically 10 protons per electron pair going through this pathway. And since we know that these protons are used in ATPase to make ATP, it gives us a measure for the yield. That's done by Paracoccus, an obligate strict aerobe, Pseudomonas, and also mitochondria. Helicobacter, which goes in our stomach, has a variation of that in the sense that the cytochrome C oxidase only pumps 1 proton. E. coli hasn't even a cytochrome C oxidase. E. coli has a cytochrome B oxidase. So the difference here, right off the bat, between these organisms is 10 protons, 9 protons, 8 protons. So respiration is not respiration. E. coli is even more clever. E. coli has 2 cytochrome oxidases. There is 1 a BO and a BD cytochrome oxidase. The BO oxidase pumps 4 protons. The cytochrome BD oxidase doesn't pump any proton. This is expressed when oxygen levels are really low. So the difference in yield is twice. So these pathways catalyzing the same overall reaction is half efficient. And E. coli has this, and E. coli can regulate that. So if you move then to an ecosystem and think about this rate yield trade-off, so what does it ultimately bring if there is a pathway that is faster at the expense of a good yield? So this is also part of the theory developed in Sebastian Bonhoeffer's lab, saying the payoff, basically, of the flux times the time the flux is essentially the total amount of ATP that is produced. So if you want to know how much of these resources are ultimately used, you introduce this payoff and also the amount of substrate utilized. Under conditions where there's no competition, basically resolve this equation here by resolving this for T and then substituting T here, then you come to this equation, which basically says that the payoff is the substrate consumed times N. If I have more substrate, there's more biomass produced. But if I have an efficient pathway, if NATP is large, I produce more biomass. Makes sense. If you introduce competition, and competition is basically introduced here, saying that the flux of substrate not only goes to the organism, but also to a competing organism. And if this flux to the competitor is actually larger than the flux of substrate going to the organism, you can neglect this term. And then come to this relationship here, where it basically says, in order for P to be large, NATP needs to be small. Which says, basically, under conditions of competition, it's better to have an inefficient pathway. Yes?
So, the thing that really confuses me about this is that in your first talk, you managed to convince me that the total rate is set really by ATP being burned in translation, that this sets the irreversibility of the reaction and basically sucks on the catabolic pathways, and you can run the catabolic pathways basically without producing any heat, because the total flux to the thing is really controlled by the anabolic part. And now you're arguing everything only on the catabolic part. And so this is really confusing.
Well, I didn't mean to make the argument as strong as you articulated.
Okay.
for deductive purposes, that's fine. This basically is just another way to look at this and to bring order in order to see how pathways and rates and yields and ultimately pathway architecture is related. I don't see that this is a contradiction.
And so you're saying I then believe, well, you can only look at the whole thing, catabolic coupled to anabolic, to work out how the rates are going to be in the end. And now you're sort of cutting it in half and just look at the catabolic part, right?
No. See, at the level of ATP, so the argument here is, okay, so for an organism, that grows here, we just said, under competitive conditions, it is better if the organism has a strategy that gives you low ATP but a high rate. So the flux of ATP ultimately is high.
And the flux of writing down that curve, you're already kind of, I think,
yes,
dodging Eric's question.
The flux of ATP ultimately brings that ATP that is then used in anabolic reactions. Let me just go there, and I'd be happy to talk. I want to go through.
Sure.
So the point here is, from the theory, you can make a prediction that under competitive conditions, it's better to be inefficient, and inefficiency has basically a higher flux. Okay, so where, yes?
Yes, yeah, so is this competition in resource-rich or resource-poor environments? Because I know a lot of the ecology theory says that if there's kind of resource-poor environments and you need some minimal amount of energy to sustain life, then yield is favored over.
Yes, that's true. That's still true.
And so I'm trying to square those two things.
So I didn't address this, but it also implies sort of a rich. I can find it later. I have the graph for that. But I just want to give you some examples how you can explain patterns of diversity, different metabolic features that you find in nature based on these principles. It might be more complex, but at least there are ways to think about it. So I'm looking at organisms that degrade organic matter. I'm getting back to our redox tower. That's God gave us this tool, and it works pretty well. So we are looking at the fate of organic matter with different electron acceptors. So we are looking here at different electron acceptors. When there's oxygen around, so if you have soil, you basically find organisms that this reads carbon and electron flow under oxic conditions. But pretty much where a single organism can oxidize the entire compound. Take Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas actually has many pathways for aromatic compounds, for amino acids, for sugars. But it has the feature and does oxidize this completely. If you look on the other spectrum, thermodynamic spectrum, where there is actually very small energy available, but that's not the point. Here under methanogenic conditions, you have a high level of speciation, metabolic speciation, that the overall pathway of converting biomass to CO2 and methane, that's the overall pathway, is actually not in a single organism. There's no single organism enough methanogenic conditions that catalyzes the overall pathway. But the overall pathway is sort of speciated in different groups. There's one group of primary fermenters, that's the type of lactic acid bacteria, propionic acid bacteria that you have. Or when you make the cheese, who's doing the cheese? The cheese. So when you're fermenting cheese, we are talking about really here primary fermenters, and all these compounds, these end products, make the flavor of the cheese. So this is good. And when you make cheese, you stop the fermentation there and basically prevent that these organisms come up. If you have an unsterile system, inevitably they will come up. But in a sediment, in the rumen of the cow, in our own intestine, we have other organisms like synthrops that disproportionate these compounds into hydrogen and acetate, which are key intermediates. And hydrogen and acetate can either go to methanogens. There are two types of methanogens, one that are specialized to use hydrogen, another type that use acetate. And they are homoacetogens that convert hydrogen into acetate. There's some beautiful biochemistry in there, but you can think about this, that this is all a partitioning of an overall pathway into different organisms. And you can think about it this happens as in the Stulian Adams experiment. So if this is true, so now let me ask you the question. So that makes sense, but why is it that an aerobic organism doesn't have that? Right? So I can make the same argument for an aerobe. Why doesn't aerobe speciate also in three or four other organisms, all using oxygen, but then still oxidizing, let's say, glucose or amino acids to intermediates, and so on and so forth. Any thoughts?
Is it to do with efficiency of the different pathways?
Interesting thought. The efficiency, I think, based on what I said this morning, to some extent is can be biologically controlled. To another extent, is constrained by biochemistry of transformation. Any other thoughts?
Have to do with resource limitation?
In what way?
Substrate limitation.
Would you elaborate a little bit more?
So the Julian Adams experiment was under conditions of glucose limitation, where you saw that emerge. But if you grew it with an excess, then there's no benefit to, you know, cutting to the chase and using up that resource necessarily.
So how does this then play out for the aerobic world?
So my guess would be that in the aerobic world, you have an abundance of both electron donors and electron acceptors. But once you get to the anaerobic world, you're dealing with sort of breakdown products that have been passed over once by aerobic metabolism, so you're more substrate.
What do you guys think? Is that true? What you said, that in the aerobic world, there's an abundance of resources?
I actually do not quite understand the context of the question. If you take E. coli, it is excreting acetate or not excreting acetate, whatever, depending on the conditions. So what do you mean here?
Okay, what I mean, that's a good question. So I'm not just talking about E. coli. You showed that if you grow E. coli slowly, it is efficient.
Right, but if you grow fast, it's right.
Yeah,
so,
right.
So what do you...
Right, so I'm talking about organisms other than E. coli. So how do we understand the features of a Xanthomonas, a Xanthobacter, a Mycobacterium, or a Pseudomonas for that matter, which do have sort of non-speciated pathways?
Well, E. coli is also not a speciated pathway, right?
Right.
So is this referred to particular conditions, or?
Yeah, so I'm trying to probe, actually, you set it up in a sense, that what is it really true that in the wild, not in the lab, in the wild, resources for an aerobic organism are infinite? No.
I don't believe.
Because
of competition.
For what?
Electron donors.
Okay. And what else? Yes, so let's think about this a little bit more. Acceptor is oxygen, right? What's the solubility of oxygen in water? 200 micromolar. And it's limited by diffusion. So many aerobic ecosystems are oxygen limited. So the time that an aerobe is really good at aerobic respiration is fairly short-lived and variable. If the soil is dry and it still has some moisture there, it's great because you have 20% oxygen coming in. If it rains, it gets tough because it becomes oxygen limited very, very rapidly. In other words, my point is aerobic environments in nature actually are more fluctuating than stable, which does not favor ultimately the speciation because organisms have to adapt to these conditions of rapid oxygen limitation or even depletion. On the other hand, in methanogenic environment, if you take the rumen of the cow does nothing else than eating grass. But grass, the cow cannot use the grass itself. It uses basically these end products from primary fermenters, which are then reabsorbed in the cow. The cow keeps on eating cellulose all the time. That's a pretty stable environment. And there's no limitation of electron acceptor because the electron acceptor is derived from the organic matter glucose. And there's bicarbonate, which is the end product of this oxidation reaction. So we are producing CO2 here, which I didn't put in. So the electron acceptor CO2 is omnipresent. In fact, under those conditions, there is no other electron acceptor needed. And I contend that these conditions, they are predictably stable, that under those conditions, you have a speciation of pathways in organisms.
So this will go back to the question I was asking in our first lecture on Monday, right? So you're arguing here about environmental fluctuations or that, but in principle, I can have organisms that carry all of these and just use regulated research.
Yes, but we don't find it. I know. I don't say that I'm right, but I think this is a reasoning that is based sort of on one hand excellent metabolism. We just don't find these organisms. Maybe you could argue maybe we only looked in high flux environments like the rumen of the cow. Maybe if we would have an anoxic environment with very little substrate, like if you go in the deep sea, maybe then you would find these organisms there. I don't know if that's possible. But from the organisms that we have studied so far, it's this feature that we do have segregation of an overall pathway in individual organisms. And I'm just saying that there is this correlation with the stability of the... with the stability of the niche or the environment, I don't want to get into niche, there's sort of this interesting correlation, and you can actually fill this in a little bit more. If you look at sulfate-reducing bacteria, so sulfate, you know, is important in the marine environment, 28 millimolar. In the sulfate-reducing environment, you have an in-between this speciation of pathways and the aerobic, in the sense that sulfate reducers substitute for these syntrophic organisms. So you still have primary fermenters, but the sulfate reducers, which is the equivalent to these methanogens, actually can access these substrates directly, which these methanogens cannot access directly. Also under ion-reducing conditions. And it is tempting to speculate that this might be also due to the fact that these concentrations are fluctuating. You also have, even in marine sediments, absence of sulfate and methanogenesis. So these concentrations change. And I'm just saying that because here you can deplete oxygen here, and then the aerobe just needs to do that, something different. You can deplete iron. Iron is also rapidly, there's not high concentrations. And freshwater sulfate is 0.2 millimolar. So that's about the same as oxygen. So the real concentrations for massive oxidations are really low, which leads to depletion, which leads to, you know, the absence of an electron acceptor, and therefore a change in metabolic strategy. That's not the case in a methanogenic environment. Okay. Do you buy that? Okay, I want to give you one last example about methanogens, where I'm going to show you one example of methanogens that use hydrogen and CO2 to convert methane. Simple, very simple metabolism, where I will show you that the rate yield trade-off is actually realized in two types of methanogen that catalyze the same overall reaction. So this is the pathway for reducing CO2 to methane. And all you need to know is that we are consuming four pairs of reducing equivalents. This CO2 is reduced to formate. Formate is then, well, and simultaneously bound to one coenzyme. We have a switch of coenzymes and subsequently reduce this carbon to a methyl group. You switch coenzymes. That's all not important. What is important is that the last step, well, actually two. The last step of methane formation is this enzyme, catalyzed by this enzyme, a methyl coenzyme M reductase, where the electron donor is actually a sulfhydryl group from a coenzyme. So once methane is formed, this coenzyme is oxidized, and you get a heterodisulfide of two coenzymes and a disulfide bond, which is then reduced with reducing equivalence. Now, energetically speaking, it is basically the hexagonic reactions is here in the transfer of the methyl group, which is an interesting and unusual case. But there's energy, and there's actually, this is the only example, or one of the few examples, where you have energy conservation to pump sodium across the membrane without a redox reaction. It's just a switch between two coenzymes. And we have the two last reactions, which is basically methane formation and the reduction of this heterodisulfide with hydrogen. So in other words, here's energy available. And the difference in strategy that leads to a rate yield trade-off type of organisms is actually in how they deal with that. So the observation is the following, that they are methanogens that have cytochromes. They grow and have a growth yield, and just look at the number, it's about 7 grams of cells per mole methane. And those without cytochromes have about a growth yield is half that much for the same overall reaction. If you look at the doubling time, this is has a doubling time of over 10 hours. And this one less than 1 hour. So on the outset, it looks like a great rate yield of high yield, low rate. Low yield, high rate. How do the organisms imprint or solve these? And this then gives different features. For example, this has consequences of the hydrogen partial pressure and the availability of using hydrogen. So simply by using the resource less efficiently has an effect on the environmental hydrogen concentration. So if you plot the delta G for methane formation, so we basically have hydrogen plus CO2, and we are making a certain number of ATPs and methane and produce water, and plot this in the dependence of the hydrogen partial pressure. So that's a simple a Gibbs equation. This line here is a threshold of minus 20 kilojoule, which is generally considered the threshold of life. If there's energy less than 20 kilojoules available this is not the use for energy conservation. That's the energy actually that's necessary to pump one proton across the cytoplasmic membrane in a membrane potential of 180 millivolts. That's sort of considered. If you can't pump one proton, you're out of luck. So, depending on what the stoichiometry here is, these lines are shifted. With one ATP, you're basically hitting this threshold at 30 Pascal hydrogen partial pressure. If you only conserve half an ATP, right, a lower yield, you can lower this hydrogen partial pressure due to 2 Pascals. In other words, at low hydrogen partial pressure, these inefficient organisms can outcompete the more efficient organisms. How is this solved? So it is all about related how these electrons get into the organism. In the case of methanocyanina, which has cytochromes, there's an enzyme complex which reduces this heterodisulfide. So you can think about this actually as a type of respiration. There's phenazine, which is essentially a flavin type of molecule that is an electron acceptor, taking electrons from hydrogen. Where's hydrogen? Here's hydrogen. And then reducing this heterodisulfide to these two coenzymes. And in this process, 4 protons are pumped. It's kind of the respiratory chain, a poor man's version of the respiratory chain for a methanogen. But it's reminiscent of that what aerobes do. So these 4 protons. Now, what I haven't told you is that the activation of this CO2 to the formyl group requires actually energy, because you need to produce ferredoxin. That's a mechanistic constraint on the pathway. So you have to the organism consumes 2 protons in what is called a reverse electron transport to activate electrons from hydrogen to make a reduced ferredoxin. So basically, out of this scenario, there are 2 protons net formed in a pathway of methanogenesis, which has this heterodisulfide reductase and phenazines. The organisms without cytochromes have a different solution for that. The organisms without cytochromes that have a lower yield but grow faster basically have a type of biochemistry which is called electron bifurcation, which basically says while hydrogen is more has lower redox potential than this heterodisulfide, this exergonic reaction can be coupled with an endergonic reaction of activating hydrogen to ferredoxin without any proton pumping. I'll show you the mechanism in a minute because it's actually quite important. But from the overall equation, you can see that there is no protons pumped here. The other one got 2 out of this. So you need 2 hydrogen. One is the reduction of this coenzyme heterodisulfide. That's fine. And in the end, you produce a reduced ferredoxin. That's what you need. In the previous case, we had, again, there was 2 protons net formed. And that's the difference in the yield, because the 2 other ones are formed here in this transfer reaction. Now, I can stop here, or I can tell you more about the bifurcation, which is a huge thing in the anaerobic biochemistry. But are you guys ready for a coffee? Okay. So the bifurcation is totally cool. I mean, so bifurcation was discovered actually around 8 to 10 years ago. Again, in the overall scheme, you have reducing equivalence. In a protein machinery where an exergonic reaction, and we're looking just at the thermodynamics, an exergonic reaction drives an endergonic reaction. So in this case, we're looking at NADH. The in situ redox potential is minus 280 millivolts. And if you take butyrate formation, for example, in your Clostridia, which are the type 1 fermenting organism. Butyrate UCA is formed from croton UCA by a reduction that redox potential is minus 10 millivolts. If I transfer electrons from minus 280 to minus 10, that's an exergonic reaction. That is mechanistically coupled with the reduction of a ferredoxin to do other things. So if you think about the evolution of metabolism, God gave us ferredoxins. Everything started with ferredoxin, and then NADH type of oxidoreductases came in. Because this reduced ferredoxin can now do several things. It can reduce protons to make hydrogen. Now, if these electrons are coming from hydrogen, you can basically conserve energy in this reaction. You can use this for CO2 fixation, for nitrogen fixation, or for the activation of aromatic compounds biochemically. So, the way it works is you have flavins, where you essentially reduce a flavin, so you have NADH coming in that reduces a flavin here, so you have the reduced form of flavin. And flavin has the amazing property that it can be both a 2-electron transfer compound, but also 2 1-electron transfer compounds. NAD doesn't do that. Therefore, when this I'm pointing to the wrong one, so this one. When this reduced flavin only oxidizes, sort of gives off one electron, you get a radical, a flavin radical. Flavin radicals are somewhat stable, but radicals are very reactive. And these radicals then can reduce iron sulfur cluster and ferredoxins. So the point is, the flavin radical is very reactive, which means nothing else than being able to do that. And this is driven by a first hexagonic oxidation of one electron. I'd be happy to talk about this, but this is sort of the last slide, just to point out where we all find this electron bifurcation. And we basically find it everywhere. In strict anaerobes, like here, for butyrate formation in Clostridia, fermenting Clostridia, we find it in hydrogen metabolism. We find it in methanogenesis, and we find it also in transhydrogenation, which is really important. How the cell manages the pool of electrons from the catabolism, the NADH pool, to the pool of reducing equivalents in the anabolism, which is typically the NADPH pool. This is also controlled by this bifurcation. So the point here, the variation of the pathway to allow organisms to change strategies from a high rate to a high yield organism is simply whether or not the organisms can bifurcate electrons or have a methanophenazine type of respiration onto a skeleton metabolism of methanogenesis by reducing the carbon compound from CO2 to methane. I know this is heavy stuff, but you get the idea that actually you find examples of radial trade-off. Okay, I think it's now time for coffee.
We'll discuss this later, but I just want to register for students. I just want to register my doubts for this radio. The numbers are forgotten, but the rate ultimately comes from enzyme.
Right.
And in principle, at slow growth, you can use the enzyme to do whatever, and this rate, you can make this rate very high. I don't see where the where does this rate come from?
So you're saying that in the case of E. coli.
In anything, I mean, you can spend enzyme to boost up the rate.
Except then evolution selects for high specific activities or different specific activities in enzymes.
But I can make lots of enzymes.
Or you make enzymes with different specific activity, then you get by with smaller proteome real estate.
No, but the same activity, but lots of enzymes, right? I can boost up the yield. The rate. And then, so where is the limitation?
Well, the limitation is because you infringe in the proteome space.
But the slow growth, I have lots of proteome space to do.
But I mean, this is what I showed you. This is primarily for growth under competitive conditions. So
we're talking about very slow growth, right? We don't need many for ribosome. We don't need for many for antibody. This can be slow.
Yeah, but I mean, point well taken. The data that we have and the microbiology is basically all based on fast-growing organisms. I'm not saying that if we are looking carefully in deep sea sediments, where we expect doubling times in the order of 100 years or so, that these principles may not apply or may be different.
But even when you're looking at these processes of 5-10 hour doubling, it's anyway,
we'll leave. Can I ask something about coming back to this experiment of Julian Adams?
Yeah.
So he finds E. coli speciates into two subtypes. One runs the first half of the pathway, the other one runs the other half of the pathway. Mm-hmm. But I presume if you look in these E. coli, they didn't get rid of all these genes in this small amount of time, no?
No.
So are we talking really about two phenotypic states?
The mutations, maybe you would know this better, Paul. I think there's an uptake. It's all upregulation. So the mutations are mainly in regulators. So they didn't. There's no loss of respiratory genes.
You save on glycolysis.
I mean, this basically, all it means is you need to upregulate glycolysis by a factor of 2, and you're fit as the wild type. Which is totally in evolutionary reach.
But so you could do this all with one genotype.
That's so easy to figure out over the span of the study. In principle, you can.
You can do it with one genotype.
We'll do it one genotype, but then you need to figure out, what proportion there's a lot of things to figure out, but overall, you need to modify the glycolysis regulation.
Like a bet hedging.
You fix those two populations, and because it's such a cost environment, why do you bother with bed hedging?
So, as I said, I mean, in order to have the same flux of ATP product, you need to upregulate the glycolysis by a factor of 2, and then you have.
Now, I'm extremely fascinated by this idea that when you have a constant environment versus variable environment, you either get a generalist versus more a combination of specialists, but it's still not so obvious to me where exactly that is.
It's even in the Adams experiment, the environment is fluctuating because, at the start of, it's chemostat, sorry, not bad. No, my bad. Yeah, once you're but if you do it in batch, right? If you do it in batch, you can still get this kind of specialization where you get ones that eat glucose first, and then there's another type that eats acetate that comes in.
It's citrate.
But
in general, batch experiments. I mean, yeah, citrate, right? I mean, batch experiments do find cross feedings evolving too.
That's also
I think it's easier to explain in batch, right? Because it's not a stable environment and then it's code.
So there my point, but I'm not totally off where I say that it's a it fluctuates over the course of one cycle.
But there is a prediction, right? The prediction says variable environments you'll find many small genome guys that each do a little bit. Variable environment you find big genome guys that all do lots of things. That's a prediction, right?
Yeah.
So that's the observation, right? That's the observation. And I think what I presented is an idea to have a theory to make this prediction.
So where would you put E. coli on this?
E. coli goes in a highly fluctuating environment. Because in the gut, basically, that's what I like the Thomas Italy experiments. E. coli at low concentration expresses all kinds of pathways, regardless of whether the substrates are present. Yeah. So E. coli, just like Salmonella, I think has a strategy to run many pathways simultaneously to be in fats. And that's a good strategy of intestinal organisms.
That's just as far as the carbon substrate is concerned. So you express all of these, so it's substitutable. That's fine. But in terms of oxygen or lack of that sort of thing, it's extremely stable. I mean, you cannot be more stable in the gut.
E. coli does mixed acid fermentation, has a cryptic nitrate reduction, can absorb this by there are planned metabolic plans for dealing with oxygen.
It's carrying all of them.
Right.
So
mitochondria are paracrine cousins. Don't have any planned metabolic plan needs. So therefore I'm saying E. coli typically grows or exists the population in a fluctuating organic rich environment. But it's not good at starvation.
Is it real clear the environment is fluctuating? I mean, relative to what? Do we have a measurement that shows that the gut is more fluctuating than the oligotrophic ocean in some sort of real sense? I don't know enough biochemistry, but couldn't it be that these pathways speciate because of biochemical constraints on reactions that are doable with specific sets of enzymes or something, and the environmental fluctuation is actually irrelevant?
I mean, for the microbiota, we know that it fluctuates from a day-to-day basis, the composition change.
Well, and also oxygen that comes in
from the
electron acceptor that are produced based on inflammation, reactive nitrogen species, reactive sulfur species. Electron acceptors, which are, from fumarate produced or any other organic compound of electron acceptor, it is much more variable.
Certainly the concentration of carbon is higher in my gut than in, the bay outside, but the dynamics.
Yeah, we need some, objective measurable quantities, right? Otherwise, we can say, more variable, less variable. It's hard to sit in them down, right?
But you can look at it from here.
No, I'm not saying I know how to do it, right? But it's sort of, you hit the sort of a wall when you realize you don't really know how you can use it.
Yeah, but I think this points to a really important question, so how do you really quantify in a microbiologically meaningful way in the environment, because in as much as we talk about pathways, we typically have qualitative ideas in thinking about the environment, but in the end it is paramount for the activity of the microbes.
Do you have like methanogens that's in in some other environment? So you have this one situation where lots of little abuses, right?
Yeah, so we talked about, we want to do some experiments using these methanogens, which are label speciators and highly specialized. There is no alternative metabolism. It's not like E. coli. So the question is, what are these organisms, how are they doing with high growth, low growth, and yield and coupling? So I'm not saying that, the examples that I gave you, where, for example, E. coli, simply by controlling the expression of this different cytochrome oxidases, only works if organisms have these features. Right? So I gave you the feature, but I'm saying they are the examples where you have a great yield trade-off, biologically wired. Many organisms don't have this. And I think the correlation is that in
in stable, predictable environments, you have either organisms that are fast, where you have already a biologically speciated great deal of trade-offs, rather than one organism being able to adapt.
In the case of, that you presented with E. coli and its two different oxidases, is the one with the lower yield faster? That's the prediction?
That would be the prediction. So you have to do experiments to go E. coli in an oxygen middle of chemostat. No, that doesn't help because the growth rate is the same.
Yeah.
So you need to measure. It's experimentally difficult to show that.
But the key observation is that they have these.
So we have done lots of experiments trying to knock out efficient pathways for E. coli. It doesn't do anything to growth rate, it just drops the yield. In almost all cases we try, we don't see this right here.
See, you talk about kind of two trade-offs. One is like static versus, or two kind of niche strategies. One is like static versus variable environment. One is growth yield. Are those the same trade-off, or are they?
So
you're talking about two dimensions of the niche space, where one is static versus constant, or static versus variable environment, and the other is high growth rate, and the other is high yield. Are those actually two distinct axes, or are they kind of the same things co-vary along that those two dimensions?
I think that's an interesting question worth looking at. I don't know. Get some coffee before we